Hello, everyone, and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema. I'm your host, Lara Romans, and I'm here with our producer, Elliot Bloom, to talk about some new releases in cinemas right now. Today we have a feast of films for you as we discuss sentimental value, Joachim Trier's movie about two daughters and their estranged father set within the world of the film industry. We take a look at Harris Dickinson's directing debut with the story of a homeless guy in London in the movie Urchin. We also touch on Mary Bronstein's If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, starring Rose Byrne, which is a story about mom burnout, but it feels like a straight-up horror. Also, Shi Jing Tzu's debut Left-Handed Girl, produced and edited by Sean Baker, which follows the life of a single mother and two daughters who adjust to their new life in Taipei. But first, some cool things happening here at Lab 111 in Amsterdam in the coming weeks. Check out our festive classics program, including Home Alone, Die Hard, which is a Christmas movie, and of course my personal favorite, The Apartment. Also, our straight-to-video screening on the 26th of December is Silent Night, Deadly Night, which should be a riot. And for something more cozy, our girly pop series celebrates the world of girlhood on screen. And we'll be screening another holiday classic, The Holiday. Because we also want to take a little holiday. We're recording this quite a little bit ahead, which means that there's some movies that I've seen, there's some movies that Elliot's seen. Other than what you're used to from us, we'll be taking turns a little bit more in talking about these releases. And I'm going to kick it off with Sentimental Value. Sentimental Value is the new Joachim Trier, who kind of hit a home run with his last movie, The Worst Person in the World. He teams up with Renate Reinsve again for this tangled story about a complicated family, which won the Grand Prix at Cannes. The father, Gustav, played by Stellan Skarsgård, is a filmmaker who abandoned his family when his two daughters were young. They reconnect after the death of their mother. He wants to make a comeback film based on his own childhood and offers his daughter, Nora, the lead role of his mother. That's something she's not really ready for. Then he gives the part to a young, successful Hollywood actress, Rachel Kemp, played by Elle Fanning, which complicates things even further. Here's a clip.
Why didn't you want to do the role? He wanted you to do it.
I can't work with him. We can't really talk. My father is a very difficult person.
I really feel like other people liked The Worst Person in the World a lot more than I did.
Yeah. Why didn't you like The Worst Person in the World?
I didn't not like it. I think that was one of those releases that I kind of missed in the previews. So I saw it kind of when it came out. And then by that point, I'd already heard so much hype about it that my expectations were through the roof. And then I was a little bit like, oh yeah, that was nice. But, you know, like, yeah. And I think what his movies also do really well is that they play to very real emotions. And if those aren't the emotions you're currently struggling with, it might not hit as hard as it might for other people. But this one, I really feel like there's something about this movie that really has that je ne sais quoi of this is just a really talented filmmaker. I feel like so many of the choices that he makes are not even explainable. It's like, this is good because of this and this and this. It's just the whole time you're like, oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, okay. Mm. Wow. And I also just got out of this movie, so I haven't really had a lot of time to gather my thoughts, but I was just looking at my notebook and I saw that a word that I kept coming back to was textured, which is something I love to notice in costume design and set design when the characters wear sweaters that are pilled and collars that are stretched and their sheets are crinkled and there's an open box of Ricola on the nightstand and there's dust bunnies on the ground and their plants are clearly thirsty. Like all of these things make it feel very realistic. But I also kept coming back to the words textured and lived in when it comes to all these different stories that they're telling, because a less skilled filmmaker would have had a problem juggling all these storylines, because there's Nora, who's an actress. She's a stage actress. She has anxiety. Her sister, Agnes, is a mom, has a husband, has her own family life. Their mom dies. The house is a character, basically, where many generations have grown up. Stellan Skarsgård is very you meet him and you immediately understand who he is in this universe. Like, he's a lauded filmmaker. He immediately portrays that gravitas and is such a recognizable character. And all these storylines, there's plenty more because there's also Elle Fanning and like her role in this fictional world. You immediately understand who everyone is, what their relationships are to each other, and why. It does it so efficiently, which just makes them feel very lived in. And I thought that is such a great... I mean, I said we were recording this a little bit before. I recently went to see Wicked for good. I just want to, for some reason, make Wicked catch some strays. But, like, something I noticed in Wicked for good, for example, is they have all these storylines and they just don't manage to tie them together in a believable way. Yeah. I don't know why I had to bring that up, but it's like this just immediately is like, yeah, all of this makes sense. I know who all of these people are within 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And I really loved it.
What is at the core of this film for you? Because it's clear that it's very competently made, but what is it that really spoke to you, or that I know you're still processing it, but what did you take away?
Well, I think, so this is a family where you have this patriarch, right? Yeah. This like strong father who is shown in flashbacks to be aggressive and overbearing, and they show him like whenever they like go somewhere or they're like at a restaurant, he's like flirting with the waitress. Yeah. Like, it's this like man, you know that man.
Yeah.
And the kind of trauma that gave his daughters, the fact that they had to take care of each other from a very young age, but also he's a man who always will think art is more important than people.
Mm.
There's this beautiful scene where, I don't think this is too much of a spoiler, but they make this movie in the end. So they're going to make this movie. They're going to make it for Netflix, which I think is a hilarious name drop in this. I don't know how they got permission to do that, but that's really funny. So they make this movie for Netflix, and Stellan Skarsgård's character is like, I really want to work with this one cinematographer that I've made all of my movies with. That's like the one thing I want for this movie. And then he goes to see this cinematographer who was his close friend and collaborator for so many years. And then he realized that, oh, this guy's gotten pretty old and he won't be able to do handheld camera.
Yeah.
And then he goes, yeah, I just got to think Netflix maybe wants to talk to some other people. and like these little situations just show that who this man is. He's a man who will always choose art over connection with people.
Mm.
And I think it's also about what that does to a family, even though this entire family ended up in the art industry. What I also think it does really expertly is I love a movie about movies. I love a I love a movie about making movies. And the framing devices and structures of this movie are really fun because you at a lot of moments, you're not really sure if you're watching a flashback, if you're watching a movie that Gustav made, if you're watching their lives, if it's fiction, like it all kind of like bleeds together. You might be watching like a play that Nora's in, and you never really know where you are until it reveals where you are.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really well done. And I think that really contributed to the fact that constantly I was just going, huh, oh, nice. Yeah, cool. I really liked how it dealt with like flashbacks and movies and everything kind of interweaving into this not an annoying art housey like what's real and what's not. It's just like, oh, I might be watching one of Gustav's movies, or is it something else? Like I thought it was really well done.
What I like about Joachim Trier is that he really takes his audience seriously enough that he doesn't feel he always has to explain things. So like from The Worst Person in the World, it would always, similar to what you're saying, cut between these different themes, I think more between dreams and the surreal elements, and there's never a need to explain it.
Yeah.
You just will figure it out if it makes sense for you.
I noticed that too, that he's someone, and I think especially in these days of second screening, where everything has to be explained in dialogue, he doesn't really do a lot of that. Yeah. And I think that makes you feel smarter as an audience member, which we all want to feel smart all the time.
And I feel like it sounds to me that he's sort of in his golden era almost, that he's reaching his peaks of just this great run of films, because I think before The Worst Person in the World, he his films are often trying to capture this sense of melancholia and a nostalgia for a past self or mm-hmm. a loss of a younger self. But here it seems like he's able to evolve that to something a bit more, which, yeah, I'm excited to see this film and also what he continues to do, because he yeah. feels very confident now in everything he's doing.
I mean, and that's the thing. You can tell that him and Renate Reinspe have been like longtime collaborators, and I really like that he keeps her around, but then he also adds in these like world-class actors. Stellan Skarsgård is
yeah.
just amazing. And even Elle Fanning, I think she's incredibly talented at portraying this actress who might not be the right actress for yeah. the role. So she has to be so good that she portrays this actress as kind of like sometimes a bit clunky. And yeah. like, I think the nuances of, and then she has to go back to her real self, which she then, yeah. I think it's very layered. And I like to see him doing this with like bigger actors and then really, really managing to hold his ground.
Yeah, side note, I think Elle Fanning, somehow remarkably, she gets typecasted in a way, but always manages to break free from that or yeah. show something more deeper to the characters mm-hmm. that she's being asked to portray. And I think
see Badlands yet?
No. Don't ruin it.
It's fun.
Okay.
Urchin is the directorial debut from Harris Dickinson, who is already one of the hottest young actors in Hollywood, but apparently that wasn't enough. Urchin tells the story of Mike, a young unhoused guy in London with a drug problem. After serving some time in prison, Mike is released and tries to rebuild his life. He gets a job at a hotel restaurant. He finds a place to stay in a hostel. However, this movie shows that for people trying to pick their lives back up, only one or two dominoes need to topple for the whole thing to go down the proverbial drain. Here's a clip.
So tell me about this job.
Yeah, I've got a chef role in a hotel.
Enjoy yourself. It's one of the best hotels in London, so...
Is it?
Yeah, it's on the top list in UK.
What did you think of Urchin?
I had... Okay, so I have to say, initially, I started watching this movie and I was annoyed. And I'll tell you why. And also, I'll tell you why. It's because I know that this actor, Frank Delane, he's a Nepo baby. His dad is Stannis Baratheon in Game of Thrones, and he's this like famous actor. His mom is also an actress. So I was a little bit turned off of it, thinking like, oh, here's two rich boys cosplaying like libertine style.
Yeah.
So I was a little bit like, what am I watching? But then, you know, turns out, Franklin, who, by the way, also was in Harry Potter, as you might know this, you're younger than me.
Tom Riddle.
Young Tom Riddle in like the sixth movie or something.
Yeah, so he's like young Voldemort, basically.
Yes.
Voldemort before Voldemort.
Right. So
Before the nose job.
So does that make him young Ralph Fiennes? I don't know enough about Harry Potter to
kind of, yeah.
I was like, ugh, this is two rich boys cosplaying as homeless people. I found it a little bit offensive. And then I started reading about, well, first of all, actually, Frank really won me over with his performance. I thought it was a great performance. Then I also quite liked the movie. I thought it was pretty well made. And then I started reading about Harris Dickinson and his background.
Yeah.
Coming from a working class background, the jobs that Michael has in the movie are jobs that he actually had in real life. And I think even the restaurant that he works at is the actual restaurant that he worked at.
Yeah, the hotel.
The hotel restaurant. And he does an insane amount for charities.
Yeah, he volunteers at food kitchens.
Yeah. So then I'm like, I completely turned around on it. It's like, wait, yeah. This guy is amazing and we love him and what an icon. And so in the end, I thought it was a really respectable debut.
Mm.
I don't think it was flawless.
Yeah.
But I liked it.
Yeah.
It was good.
I think that's a fair assessment. I think I was pleasantly surprised, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. I was like, whenever an actor turns to filmmaking, you also don't know if it's just kind of like, oh, I'm now in a position where these opportunities come to me. Let's right. just give it a go for fun. But he yeah. takes it very, very seriously. I actually recommend anybody to watch his Criterion Closet
right.
interview, because it gives you an insight of how much he really does love films. And the films he picks out are also very much, for me, influences that you see in...
what are they? Because I wrote down some potential.
We probably have the same one, but Ken Loach and Mike Lee, he picks yep. out a couple of their films. He also talks about how he has a tattoo of the bird Kez, which comes from Ken Loach's sort of one of his most famous films, which shows you just how much of a fan he is. And it is, you see that in the film.
Absolutely.
It's very social realism to the point where I'm always thinking, like, how did they shoot this? Were they just on the streets with a camera recording all of this? And what I did like is that he then doesn't confine himself to this one particular genre. He expands on it. He sort of goes through these surreal elements as well. And
can I just say that was crazy, because I was watching it with my partner and he was kind of like sitting at the table, because honestly, he's not really allowed to watch the screeners. But he was doing work. And I was watching this movie and I was like, okay, this is what it is. And then all of a sudden he looks over at the screen and we're in this weird, we physically go down a drain and we go into like cellular structure and end up in like a cave in a forest. And he's like, wait, what happened? It's like, couldn't tell you. Couldn't tell you to save my life. Yeah. What did you make of that? Like the surreal elements?
So I think it's for me trying to find his place of calm or peace or something and not knowing where that is, and also how deeply buried it is and how much he struggles to find that place. Because, as you described it, it's sort of all these encounters as someone who doesn't have a home trying to pick himself back up again, but through all his own faults of just being human, he isn't able to do that and doesn't know how to express himself, and that sort of gets stuck between. And I think Harris Dickinson does a great job at that. I think the thing that I was really impressed by is that it can be easy to show this stuff in dialogue, but that can often come across very unnatural. It can also be easy to do it in close-ups of facial expressions, but what he really allows Frank Delane to do is to use his body to tell it, especially with the slow dancing, but this time a guy doing it and not a woman. But you really feel sort of the shame that Mike's character carries and the pain that he's in and the times in which he allows it to express himself and the times he isn't able to do it. And I thought that was quite a unique thing to see that I was surprised of when I watched it.
What I also think is really respectable about making the way he made this movie is that it's so easy to make this movie and be like, the institutions are letting people down.
Yeah.
Like the government, because I actually think that all the government institutions that he interacts with function really well.
Yeah.
And are portrayed as kind and helpful.
Yeah.
But what the underlying thing is like, you can have all of these like chances, but if only one thing goes wrong, you don't have a safety net. Yeah. So you lose your job, you're back on the street. Because then you can't pay for your hostel and then and you don't have anything. And then it's so easy to fall back. And I think that's like the thesis of this movie is like, you know, one thing could go wrong and that's how people stay in this system.
Yeah.
I think that's a side of the story that I hadn't really seen before.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would agree with that. I think the only thing for me is that the praise that this film gets is probably that it humanizes a rough sleeper. And I think that's fine, but I think that should always be the bare minimum for any type of story.
Right.
I think, and of course this is just his feature debut, I would like to see him, if you're human enough, you kind of already understand that these are things that are very, can easily happen, how precarious the situation is.
Yeah.
But then how do you start to assess, or not necessarily the institutions that cause it, but the root problems of it? And I think that would be a more interesting film to look at, because I think we have enough of these kinds of, not that there's ever enough, but I would like to see filmmakers push past this idea of just doing character studies.
Yes. However, I also feel I thought it was kind of cool that we don't really see how this guy ends up on the street in the first place. We don't know what his trauma is. We don't know how he got here, what his home situation was. We don't really know any of that. And I think that that matches the reality more of when we encounter a homeless person on the street.
Yeah.
You don't know where they came from. You don't know how. But also, maybe we are afraid to like actually help someone out because of also situations that happen in this movie. So
definitely.
It is a very nuanced and balanced story.
Just to clarify, I don't necessarily mean the root causes of each each individual becomes unhoused, but more just like the structural elements of like, because in the film you see him or you see the characters discuss a bit about how capitalism and neoliberalism are the factors for this, but something that can examine that a bit more, that can help audiences understand how something so granular can then lead to someone like Mike becoming unable to get back on their feet. But yeah, I think it was really impressive. And I think both from this film and hearing Harris Dickinson talk, he also has this kind of aura and reputation around him based on the characters that he plays, of him perhaps being any other kind of actor, perhaps more in the vein of Jacob Elordi, who seems also just a bit of a dick to me. But
he's just tall.
Yeah, that's his problem. But Harris Dickinson seems much more like he's in it, that he lives film, and he really cares about what he's doing. So I hope he continues making more films.
It wasn't a 5-star for me, but I definitely enjoyed it, and I can't wait to see what he does next.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so Elliot, do you want to tell me a little bit about Left-Handed Girl?
So Left-Handed Girl is directed by Shi Ching Su. It follows a single mother, Ian, and her two daughters, Xu Fen and Yi Jing, who relocate to Taipei to open a night market stall, each navigating the challenges of adapting to their new environment while striving to maintain family unity. Yi Jing, no older than 5 years old, is told by her grandfather that she is the devil, or she has the devil's hand, because she's left-handed. And it leads to a whole sequence of events where Yi Jing becomes convinced she is responsible for all the bad things happening to her, all while her mum and sister struggle to make ends meet. Here's a clip. So some good things to know, actually. So Shi Ching Su, she not only produced the films of Sean Baker, so Tangerine, Red Rocket, and The Florida Project, but they also made a film together in 2004 called Takeout. They both directed it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so they have quite...
2004?
Yeah, a long time.
Wow, I thought Sean Baker is like not that much older than me.
Yeah, so I also thought the same, but I think it must have been, it is a feature
maybe
film.
Maybe in film school.
Yeah, it was a feature film, so it could very well be that they met in film school.
Maybe Sean Baker just has a really good plastic surgeon.
But yeah, so Sean Baker also collaborated with her on this film. He not only wrote it and produced it with her, but also edited it. His editing style is quite fun, actually. It's very sort of like... he edits in the style as if you're Yi Jing, the 5-year-old girl, in some kind of way.
In what
it's
way?
Very kind of like fast-paced, sort of scattered kind of brain, but in a way that makes sense. So like the playful nature of a child can immediately switch to something, and it's very like up-tempo. There's a real rhythm to it.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously it's set in Taipei. And I think one thing that Shi Jing does quite well is that if you say it's set in Taipei, maybe you already think of Yi Yi.
That's exactly what I was going to ask you.
And it does the complete opposite of what Yi Yi does. So Yi Yi, as we discussed before, kind of sort of really blends the city together in a very beautiful kind of way.
Yeah.
Here, there is no color grade on the film at all. So it's a bit jarring. It's a bit jarring to begin with because you're like, this is really weird. But because it's so raw, it also gives this, in a very sort of classic cliche kind of way, this almost realistic element to it that also suits the vibe of it, because it's Taipei already as a city is already, because it's so modernized and urban, and there's already enough colors and light coming to it. So that I really liked. The thing I really liked about this film is it kind of switches between stories, and not, it tells the same story in a way. It's focused around the three female characters and how they're trying to sort of survive, almost, of how tough life is in terms of just being able to afford things, but also finding relationships and struggles within the family dynamics. So the mother is in this larger, more toxic family dynamic of where the mother is very much all in on the son, and the daughters get neglected, even with money. Yeah, the funny element is that Yi Jing convinces herself that she is evil, or that bad things happen when she uses her left hand, which there are some comic moments of where, like, for instance, the meerkat, which they find, dies because she throws a ball with her left hand onto the road and the meerkat falls off the balcony to catch it.
Oh, no.
But yeah, I think, and the other thing is it follows, often the viewpoint is from the kid's perspective. So when she's moving through the night stall, it's at a much lower point of view. And it shows you how she she is exposed to things that happen in adult life that you wouldn't expect a kid to be, but how often also because she's a kid, she's able to deflect or not pay attention to it, but still she carries enough within her to be aware of things that go on that where she tries to help in ways that she wants to or to be able to. Mm-hmm. And then there's a really big twist at the end. Yeah.
Never say there's a twist if there's a twist, because now I'm going to be waiting for the twist.
Is that bad to say?
I don't know.
But it changes, it adds another layer to the story, okay. Basically. But it's a very sweet film.
Turns out she is the devil.
Not quite as sinister.
Okay.
But,
good.
Yeah, it was a very sweet film. And I think people may be put off by the no color grade aspect of it, and that it can be a bit whimsical in that nature. But I think people, you get enough out of it that it's worth going to see.
Wow, I can't wait to see it. Like, I've been seeing the posters all over. But yeah, I didn't even know this whole like Sean Baker connection. Mm. So I already thought it looked interesting apart from that. Yeah. So I think, that probably helps in the promo.
Yeah. Well, on the posters, it says produced by the producers of the Frogger Project.
I can't read, Elliot. You know this about me. True. If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You by Mary Bronstein stars Rose Byrne as Linda, a therapist and mother whose life is quite quickly spiraling out of control. Her daughter has a mysterious illness and is fed through a feeding tube. Her husband is away all the time, leaving her to juggle her job, her daughter's care, and her own mental health, which gets considerably worse when their ceiling collapses and they're forced to move into a rundown motel. Here's a clip.
I try very hard to be in control of her and everything, but may as well not even be there at all.
I don't like how it feels in my sock.
Just stay there, okay? Just hold on.
How deep is it? Are we gonna die? Is the house gonna fall on top of us? Mommy!
Hey!
Hey, we just got home, and you would not believe...
Like, what do you know about this movie? Have you, because you haven't seen it.
No, I know about your Letterboxd comment, which said that this could be a horror film, but right. Oh wait, it's the struggles of a mother.
Yes.
And I remember when we were talking about Die My Love by Lynn Ramsey, mm-hmm. you also said that this film does a better job.
Yes.
Yeah, you had higher praise for this film than you did for Die My Love.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to know why.
I just couldn't help but compare the two because I saw them quite close to each other. And if you want to hear what I thought of Die My Love, listen to a couple episodes ago, I think. Yeah. What I thought about Die My Love, to be really brief about it, is that I think that it portrays a woman going insane in only the most cliched, boring ways, where it's like very abstract and very like, this is pretty much on the other end of the spectrum, where it's very direct, it's very zoomed in, it's very Uncut Gemsy almost. I hate always saying when it's stressful to say Uncut Gemsy, but it is that. I saw another review that said this, like, this feels like a 2-hour panic attack. It does. It's just this, it really shows, and I'm not a mother, I don't know what it's like, but I see my friends sometimes, and just how hard it is to be a mother, especially when you're left to do everything by yourself. And there's other external factors making your life more and more and more difficult. I think the way it's filmed is really interesting because a lot of it's about the daughter. She has probably ARFID or an eating disorder of some sort. She won't eat. She's fed through tube. There's deadlines involved. The kid has to eat within 7 days. She has to be at her goal weight. Otherwise, this and this and this happens. This has to happen, otherwise this and this and this happens. And you can feel in everything that she's constantly spinning these plates, and every time she thinks she has one thing under control, the other thing lights on fire. And it's just this constant like juggle of the next worst thing happening. What I think is really interesting about her relationship with the daughter is that they don't show the daughter at all. So it's just on Linda and her struggle. You see, sometimes you see like a hand or like, I think for the daughter. And I was wondering why that was. And Mary Bronstein has said in an interview that it is because they wanted to focus on Linda and how she is doing the best she can. Whereas if you show the kid, you might be judging Linda for not doing the best job or all of these things. but it also adds to the kind of like fever dream nature of the movie.
And to clarify, she's not going insane.
She's not, I mean, she's just spiraling. Yeah. It's just, there's elements, there's certainly elements. Actually, pretty identical to Urchin, where there are moments where basically their ceiling collapses because of water damage, and the hole is weird. Like, there's something about the hole in this ceiling that makes you wonder, like, is this some sort of like mythical, mysterious portal to another? Yeah. Like, sometimes you think you can like see it moving or throbbing, or and there's particles in there, and identically to Urchin, it kind of like goes into the hole and goes kind of like woo. So yeah, there is a bit of an element to that, but it never really explains what that is.
Yeah.
Another thing I really liked about it is that it's Conan O'Brien's first big acting role. Conan O'Brien plays Linda's therapist. So Linda is a therapist, and she gets therapy from one of her colleagues, and their relationship is, I'd say, inappropriate in the sense that, like, she takes up so much of his time, and he's like, listen, like, your session's over. But she's like, and I think Conan O'Brien actually does a really good job. I mean, he's been in a thousand movies as Conan O'Brien, but I think this is his first, like, real big acting role. I thought he did a really great job.
To clarify, he's famous for being a show host, evening.
Oh, yes, of course.
In case people
for the people who don't know. Elliot, you're
27. I do know.
Okay, he does know. Okay, so for people that are even younger than Elliot, Conan O'Brien is a late night show host. He used to write for The Simpsons, and then late night show host.
I didn't know that.
Now he has a great podcast. After you're done listening to all of our episodes, go listen to Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend. It's really great. Another thing is, A$AP Rocky's in this movie.
Funny.
Yeah, so they get to the motel, and then A$AP Rocky is kind of her neighbor. Nice. Also, a great job from him. Great work from everyone all around. Yeah, the other thing that really I keep telling people about this movie is, like, I thought it was great. I never want to see it again.
Yeah.
It really is one of those, like, wow, that was, that was stressful, but incredibly well made. Also, Mary Bronstein has said in interviews that it's partially based on her own life as a mother dealing with, I think it was also her child being ill, and how that can feel like a total fever dream panic attack unraveling.
I'm excited to watch it.
Thought it was good. Wow, good crop this week.
Yeah.
Look at us. If we've managed to pique your interest, all of these movies are screening at Lab 111 in Amsterdam, or maybe a different theater near you. It just won't be as fun. You know where to get your tickets. It's lab111.nl. Stay connected with us at Celebrating Cinema and Lab by following at Lab111 on Instagram and Letterboxd. Do you love what we do? Support us by leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. It really helps us climb the ranks of the podcast charts. This was a Lab 111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom, with music from Hugo Emmertzahl and artwork from Studio FFF.